Good morning. The Senate 12 Finance Division will come to order. Today is February 27, 2013. We have two items on the agenda, Senate Files 301 and Senate File 262. First, we have Senate File 301, Senator Bach, relating to the Lake Superior School District Technology Levy Authorization. Welcome, Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I appreciate being up early this morning here. A little background on those of you that are rural know we represent a lot of school districts because we have a lot of geography. The North Shore is one of my districts. There's two school districts there, the Lake Superior District, which encompasses the two towns you would think of are Two Harbors and Silver Bay. They have two high schools in those two towns about 30 miles apart. And then the other school district on the North Shore is the Cook County one, which is the tip of the state, encompasses the area of Cook County. So this request is for the Lake Superior District, and there are real challenges in some of our rural school districts around the state, especially in Lake Country. Lake Superior is especially challenged by the fact that in Lake County, where their school district is encompassed, the government owns over 80% of the land. So there just isn't a lot of tax capacity to be able to levy against for things like voter-approved levies. So, and it's compounded by the fact that a large piece of their tax capacity are seasonal recreational property that also is not on the voter-approved levy. So the tax burden for voter-approved levies falls on a very small population of people and a very small piece of the county's actual potential tax capacity. So this is one of the districts in the state that does not have a voter-approved levy. They've tried. They simply cannot pass one. The voters, the burden on a home is just too high because of the very limited tax capacity per pupil unit. So what the school district has come to me is asked me if they could get some legislative authority to be able to levy for technology purposes so that they can try to improve their students' experience and do things more efficiently by the use of technology. And I have with me the superintendent this morning, and he's new to the district, and I want to welcome him to the Capitol. This is his first trip here representing Lake Superior School District. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce him and have him talk kind of specifically what they would do with the technology money if the legislature were to give that to him.
Well, thank you, Senator Bach. And members, we have a number of handouts to help guide in the discussion with the fiscal note. Superintendent Crandall, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator and members. I provided a handout. We have our Lake Superior School District technology plan for 2013 through 15, and that outlines our overall projects as far as what we want to see take place in the areas of technology for our district. We are finding some money. It comes out of our general fund, and that can at times be at the expense of other programs and staffing and such. This current year actually provided new workstations for all of our teachers, for example. Some of the areas that we'd like to move into that are outlined in our plan are in the area of the wireless, the one-to-one initiatives. The information regarding those is that you buy, for example, an iPad for $400. It's not really $400. You need to then purchase the software, the licensing, the safety pieces for viruses and backups, and obviously then you also have all the internet access. You need to have the infrastructure, and we're working on the infrastructure at all of our buildings now so that if you have a wireless device that you can actually use it. Our district's also fortunate that we're having high-speed internet throughout Lake County. That's where primarily the majority of our district lies, and so our community will also have high-speed internet within the year. And if we move into having wireless devices for our kids, they'll be able to take those homes and have access to educational opportunities throughout the day, not just during the school day. We're looking at, with a one-to-one initiative, obviously, that would help us in the area of budgets in the future for textbooks. We can have the textbook online. The students would have, based on the research, a higher engagement value using the technology. It'll provide more using the flipped classroom strategy. Will provide more time for teachers to give direct instruction to students through that technology. The software that we can provide to build those skills in the areas of reading and math are areas that we would be looking at. Increasing and expanding our multimedia capabilities in the classroom. Right now we have just two or three teachers that are working on recording their lessons, posting them to the web page so that if a student is absent or home ill for a few days, they could access that if they have that capability at home. Using online systems to build our post-secondary education opportunities, also using the system to use some alternative learning options through our alternative learning program. We have the second largest geographic area. Some of the students that are not attending our school are actually doing like the virtual high school programs. What we'd like to do is be able to get those students back into our system. If we're using an online program that could access ours, the benefit there is that they would be able to actually come to the school possibly once a week to actually have face-to-face contact with their math teacher, science teacher, etc. Providing flexible learning opportunities for students will increase not just their access, but access for community as well through community education opportunities. We're looking at putting computer stations, for example, out in our library areas in the media center and in the cafeteria areas. So if students or parents need to come in and have access to computers, because that's one of the other areas we found out, you know, during just trying to get messages out to families, around 40% of our families don't even have email. And so through the access possibilities that we can provide through technology, that may be something that our community will then have more opportunities for.
And Superintendent, when will the broadband be fully implemented?
They're looking at actually this summer. Silver Bay should be able to hook into the system. Two Harbors, they're still laying some of the cable, but it's a network for the entire county. Yes, another piece Senator Buck indicated. We're on a four-day school week. We went to that. This is our third year, and the reason we went for that primarily was for budget reasons. Over the last 2 years, we've saved $397,000, which is really programs and staff. So we've been able to maintain our electives and maintain our staffing, which has been a very positive piece. What we're looking at doing is moving from to provide more opportunities for students on Fridays and also bringing in staff on Fridays so that they could work with the technology to provide some online classes. And that would be the primary day. If we had students who weren't physically in the building, they could come in on Fridays, meet with teachers, and then go home, you know, throughout the rest of the week and do some online classes. Like I said, you know, have that one day a week face-to-face time.
And Superintendent, when was your last attempt before the voters, which was rejected?
We had attempts in 07, 08, and in 2010. The last voter-approved event was a building bond in 2002.
Questions of the committee. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed on the fiscal note that it says that currently you're losing about 300 pupils to open enrollment and to charter schools.
Yes, we have a charter school on the southern end of our district. Those students are at the elementary level. The majority of them then do come back. The students that are in our district, they return to our district in seventh grade.
Senator Jensen.
Do those schools have the technology that you're looking for? I'm just curious.
Because they're a charter school, we're really not very involved at all with them. Their focus is in the environment.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions or comments from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address the committee? Well, Superintendent, we recognize the plight, the it's not fair. Students in Two Harbors, Silver Bay have the same opportunity, should have the same opportunity under our Constitution as students in Eden Prairie or White Bear or any other community in the state. You've attempted to go to the voters, and Senator Bach mentioned the limitations with only 20% of the property being on the tax roll, and that even further limited. And then nearby Cook County, I believe it's closer to 90%.
Over 90.
Yeah. And so you have the challenge of educating students with the same standards, same expectations and goals, and reducing to a four-day week. We understand there's a problem.
Mr. Chairman, it's a wonderful part of the state to represent, and I think most Minnesotans feel some connection to the North Shore and the Boundary Waters and Voyageurs National Park. But it's a very challenging place to deliver things that I think in most other places people take for granted. Public land is a wonderful thing, but it presents tremendous challenges when the legislature tells school districts, well, we don't have any money, so go raise it yourselves. And some districts just don't have the ability to be able to do that. And it's some of it in this area, it's public land. In some communities, it's just the fact that the community has too many retirees. And I'm never critical of people for voting against voter-approved levies. I mean, they have their own personal reasons, but it's just bigger challenges in some places than others. And the legislature has been making it very difficult, and I think all of you on this committee know that, over the last decade, by not providing general fund money for our kids. Fortunately, we're here to ask for a levy because the legislature and previous governors before Governor Dayton haven't done the adequate job of funding our K-12 system.
Senator Bach, we'll be laying this over for possible inclusion. At 9 o'clock, members may know the tax committee's meeting. I believe they are going to be having some related school discussions and, the whole subject of equalization. And as we put our formula and recommendations together in the school bill, the tax committee will obviously have a significant role in how that's shaped and get at the fairness issue and opportunities for all students that should be an equal opportunity. And so we'll, in fact, if there's time, I'll encourage members just to monitor what's going on in taxes right after we're done, and because I believe at least one of you does have a proposal before them today. So we'll lay that over. Senator Bach and Superintendent Crandall, thank you for sharing that, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman of Committee.
Next, Senator Johnson, Senate File 262, the Safe Schools Levy Use Expansion and Levy Increase. And we have several testifiers, and we'll ask those testifiers to join her at the table. We also have an A1 amendment, which changes the effective date, and Senator Johnson, we'll have you move that.
I move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson moves the A1 amendment, put in the shape that the author wishes. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Carried. Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Members, we're back with this bill again. Some of you have been heard testimony on this bill, the Safe School Levy, House File 3, or Senate File 262. In the Education Policy Committee, it was somewhat rushed that day, so even the people that were there probably didn't get a full picture of what is happening in our schools. Most of you know that. Our children are dealing with problems that continue to cause disruption in their education and in the education of the other students in the school. And so with this Safe Schools Levy, what we're doing here is asking that of course, the amount increases, and secondly, we're including co-location and collaboration with mental health professionals, which is, I believe, a very important part of keeping our schools safe. And so with that, I'll ask Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of NAMI, to talk about the reasons why we have this bill here.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Welcome, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. 21% of children between the ages of 9 and 17 have a diagnosable mental illness or substance use disorder, and yet only 20% actually receive treatment. Half of all adults who have a serious mental illness begin experiencing symptoms before the age of 14. Untreated, children with a mental illness are suspended at high rates, drop out of school, or end up in the juvenile justice system. And these poor outcomes follow them into adulthood. Schools are a logical place to look for how we can change this trajectory. We actually have a pretty good idea of what works. This committee will not hear the bill, but the Department of Human Services actually funds schooling to mental health services, where funds are provided to a mental health provider who then collaborates with the school. They provide clinical treatment to children and are able to bill private insurance, medical assistance, and Minnesota Care. And the grants pay for uninsured and underinsured children and for the collaborative activities that you can't bill for. From July 2008 until December 2011, we served over 13,000 children. Half of them had never received services before, and half of them had a serious emotional disorder. Because the services are provided at school, we eliminate all the barriers faced by families in terms of transportation and taking off of work. The child is more likely to complete their treatment plan, and we see the assessment show an increase in functioning. In order for this program to work, we need to have a robust student support staff, school social workers, psychologists, nurses, and counselors. They can provide some initial intervention to children before they reach the level of requiring clinical treatment. Increasing the Safe School Levy will allow districts to have more school support personnel. Another important aspect of this bill is that Safe School Levy funds can be used to pay for collaboration with a mental health professional in those districts that do not receive a schooling to mental health grant. I want to note that the reason we don't want the district to hire clinical staff, mental health professionals, is that FERPA, the law governing school records, trumps HIPAA, the law governing healthcare records, and we want to keep those records separate. We also, frankly, don't believe it's the role of the school to provide clinical treatment, but we do think it's a good idea for them to collaborate with mental health professionals so that children can receive that treatment. Also in the bill is funding for PBIS, which is Positive Behavior Intervention Services, and they do have a handout for you on that, which is Section 2 of the bill. PBIS is actually an evidence-based program that addresses social behavioral issues so that school is a safe place for all children with uniform expectations that decrease bullying and referrals to the principal. You'll see in the handout that there's actually this little triangle. It's the PBIS triangle that everybody talks about. And what it does is it really helps kind of kids at the bottom here, you know, who maybe just are having a little problem or doing fine. The kind of middle of the triangle is where the school support personnel come in and can really begin to provide those interventions. And then the very top of the triangle is the kids who have clinical needs, which is where the schooling to mental health services come in and the collaboration piece. I just want you to note that this bill is one of 12 bills that we're calling the Children's Mental Health Initiative. There isn't one thing that needs to be done to address the needs of kids with mental illnesses. There are several. This bill provides prevention, support, and intervention, all good things, and I urge your support for the bill.
Thank you.
Members, we now have three people, Sandy Lewandowski, superintendent from 287, Jeff Ronneberg, superintendent at Spring Lake Park Schools, and Don Johnson and Chris Thompson, who are with the Principals Association. And these people will tell you about the hands-on situations that they are handling in our schools, and this is why we need additional levy money.
Welcome in. Please state your name and association with.
Good morning. My name is Sandy Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287 on the west side of the metropolitan area, and I'm representing all three of the intermediate school districts in the state. And as intermediates, we do serve the highest need students oftentimes in the state. And I am here to tell you that I am asking for your support of the Safe Schools Levy. And as I sat down over the weekend to prepare my testimony, I thought about how I might explain that students we serve bring with them extraordinary disabilities, especially in the area of cognition, behavior, and oftentimes dysregulated behavior. I thought I might share how students come into our schools threatening to hurt themselves, having acute mental health crises, students who are hearing voices, students who have no conscience, and students whose plans require that staff have their eyes on them 100% of the time, and kids who cannot be left alone at times with female staff. I thought I might explain the situations where staff in my district have been hurt, broken noses, torn ACLs, broken cheekbones, broken wrists, staff who listen to threats, verbal threats, all day long, again, acknowledging that these are students who, in and of themselves, have horrific disabilities. I thought often recently about my highest responsibility as a superintendent, and I believe my responsibility at best is to keep students and staff safe. And committee members, I'm here to tell you I no longer can keep my staff safe. On Monday, I decided that the testimony I had planned over the weekend was not the testimony I needed to give, because in the afternoon on Monday, one of my staff came into my office and told me about an assault on one of our staff people. The assault was probably the most serious assault I've experienced in my 8 years as superintendent. And I quickly went out to the site where this happened to talk with the dozen staff who come in contact with the student, who again has significant disabilities cognitively and emotionally. He has a one-to-one staff person and educational assistant who works with him all day long. He has a myriad of licensed staff who attend to his educational and emotional needs. But at one point, while working with the educational assistant, there was a non-instructional staff person in the room. And for absolutely no provocation, the student who's 16 came from behind and knocked the non-instructional staff person out off his chair, unconscious. He hit his head. The educational assistant quickly tried to corner the student and use his training to prevent the student from further pummeling our staff person. He could not use his radio. All our staff have two-way radios because he needed to corner the staff. When the staff person who was injured finally started coming to, he crawled out of the room and secured help from a passing teacher. Let me tell you what will happen with this situation. This young man needs a lot of help. He needs residential treatment. But in his last residential treatment facility, he was discharged because he assaulted staff there. And after an evaluation in another facility, he was placed in a group home and enrolled in our program. As a result of this assault, he will likely be charged with a felony assault, probably third degree. He probably won't stand trial because he won't be found competent, and that's a good decision. I have absolutely no way to prevent the student from coming back into our building. We are going to try to secure a rarely used injunction, but I don't have a lot of hope that that will be successful. This student needs a lot of help, but I also need to secure a safe environment for my staff. The Safe Schools Bill will help, but frankly, the policy needs to be reviewed, and I'm asking for that help as well. While I cannot ensure my staff's safety at this point, my next responsibility is to make sure I've told legislators about the reality that is occurring, the profound shift in education that has occurred, and the safety dangers that come with it. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Lewandowski. And I also want to thank your work with AMSD and the very moving video presentation. Many of us saw that at the AMSD meeting. And just real life examples of what's going on in our area and the call for action. And so thanks for that, and we only wish you the best in going through a real challenging situation that you just mentioned.
And Mr. Chair, this is not an isolated situation. That is happening in our schools too. We know that. We all care deeply about the children, there's no doubt, but it's very important that the staff and other students are kept safe, and that's what we're all working for, because we know in this case, that it's a condition that this young person has. It's not their their desire to be that way. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am curious about how helpful or how effective the Family Collaborative resources have been for the schools in situations like this. The Family Service Collaboratives were put in place several years ago to make sure that counties, schools, agencies collaborate on coming together to address some of these issues. I am wondering if you have any thoughts on how that is working.
Ms. Lewandowski.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've been familiar with the Children's Mental Health Collaboratives for a number of years, and I would say perhaps their original purpose was well intended, and even some of their early efforts were useful in their early years. Right now, I can tell you from my district, that is not a viable source of help for us.
Follow-up, Senator Sreng.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Does your district put money into the Family Service Collaboratives?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do provide LCTS reporting and some money, and that does get contributed to the collaborative, yes.
Senator Sreng.
Mr. Chair, I am reviewing that particular provision. I believe that it was well intended, and I think that we're supposed to put resources so that these kids actually have a connection, you know, to the school, to services, to parents. And I do not believe that that is working. I hear the same response from most of the districts, and I think that we need to pay attention to it. So I would welcome your input, and I'm going to work with NAMI as well and other organizations just to hear, you know, what is that we need to do to really support the school efforts to support these children, because we need to do something about this. So I appreciate your response.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if I could just follow up that this is an extraordinarily complex situation, as you're probably aware, between the corrections and the judicial branch and human services and education. I can tell you, I was so dismayed yesterday by the situation I had occurred. I thought, I need to get to somebody. I need to go to the right head of the right agency. And frankly, that's not possible. There's no way from a school level you can intervene with the enormity of the agencies and the intersection of all these agencies together. And as a educator, lifelong educator with this population of kids, I would ask the legislature to take a significant look at policy that has driven schools to where they are today. We need to do right by our kids. We need to do right by our staff, and the current policy is not allowing that.
Thank you. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Superintendent, you made a statement about not being able to keep that student from coming back into the classroom, and I guess being new to this, can you explain to me, with that type of situation, why would you not be able to prohibit that student from being in your school?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, students with special education needs have tremendous and well-deserved legal rights. And especially when you are placed in a Setting 4 environment, which many of our programs in intermediate districts are categorically defined as Setting 4 special education programs. So even though a student may act, we are not able to exclude them in a way that a student who doesn't have special education rights would be excluded. Because in this case, clearly this student's behavior is a result of his disability. And so therefore, that is not something we could do. At most right now, I have the ability to suspend for 10 days, convene a team, but in this situation, probably everybody is going to say he is going to return, while he's being charged, while he's waiting for his trial, he will return to his group home, and he has the right to return to this setting. Even while he waits for the trial, that will probably find him not competent. So there, from a legal standpoint, our attorneys would say you cannot do anything more than a 10-day suspension other than to try to act, see whether it's viable for this very rarely used injunction.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just find it very interesting, and granted I do come from a little different angle, that not at one point in this discussion has a parent been brought up. We seem to have the answers seem to be looked at in every institution and every program. The answer is in the parent. The answer is in the family. You go back to the family and you work with them. I don't think we're the answer. Government's not the answer. Schools are not the answer. And so I have a hard time with this. I have a hard time that we have the answer, that mental health has the answer. You add more kids, and who regulates it? Who decides now, 10 years later, well, that didn't seem to work, and our schools get worse and worse and worse? I have a problem with it.
Okay, well, offering an opinion, I think, you know, it was stated that 10% of students were, you know, close to 100,000 students are diagnosed with a mental illness. I don't know if that's the parents' fault. They're probably coping with that, and I would urge you to please see if you hadn't, or to see the video that the intermediates put together, and there were parents who were very, very responsible, and it's anyone of any economic situation in life could have children impacted mental illness, and all walks of life, including our legislative family or whatever it hits. And so, they had parents in that video, that were, asking for help. And so, but I don't. That's what they had asked for, is from additional tools that could help so that their kids could go to school. But yes, Senator. And then I think some of the testifiers may want to respond.
And I'm not blaming the parents. I'm blaming the system. I think we need to change and go back and get the parents to get help. But it's their responsibility, not our system's responsibility. And I do feel for staff. I work with kids that are hard to deal with, and have been threatened and other things. But you work with the parents. That's from my point of view. The more security we have around, the more mental health we have around, I don't think is the answer to it. I think you let the parents work it out, and they can get help from the agencies that are out there.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think it brings it's. I appreciate your story today. It was I think very valuable for us to think about what schools have to contend with, and same time they're designed for educating people. But what does a school do? And Dr. Ronenberg had talked about it with me in the policy committee. What does a school do when they get a child in who is very, very needy, and there is no longer support from county? There isn't or real support. I mean, if you really fight for it, you'll get it, but it's not available readily. The school has to do something. They have to call the police, or they have to call the county, or they have to, and that's not really their job. Their job is supposed to be, teaching reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's very, very problematic, and I can just feel for the people, the administration, and the teachers who see these things every day and are watching things happen that they have no control over, or don't have the resources to have control over those. So that's what we're dealing with. But
all of us agree we have a problem.
and let's, over the next several weeks, we'll talk about avenues of addressing it. Ms. Aberholden.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, NAMI Minnesota. You know, nearly 100% of our staff and board either live with a mental illness or have a family member. I am a parent of a now 20-some-year-old, but who in her teens had very serious depression and anxiety, and I was extremely involved. And I think it's important to remember the discrimination that children and adults with mental illnesses face in our healthcare system. You know, self-insured plans until recently weren't even covered by mental health parity. Insurance plans, even under parity, don't have to cover mental health services. My daughter was under a self-insured plan. I was lucky I could get credit cards, you know, so that I could charge years of therapy, and including hospitalization, emergency room, and ambulances to a credit card to be able to get her services. Families face incredible barriers to get the treatment that they need. I get calls every day, including at 11 o'clock last night, a parent called me on my cell phone because she is fighting with the county because her son needs residential treatment. Everyone is saying at the hospital, everyone in the county is saying, no, we don't want to fund it. So, you know, while I think it's great to say we need to involve parents, I know thousands of parents who are deeply involved, who are fighting very, very hard to get those services that their children need. And they face barriers under private insurance. They face barriers under Medicaid. They face barriers with the county. And so they are doing absolutely, you know, the best that they can. And some of these barriers you just can't break down by yourself.
Thank you, Superintendent. And then we'll go to Dr. Runnenberg.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would agree with Ms. Aberholden's testimony. And in the case of the student I reference, this family is no longer involved, primarily because the mother also has a significant lifelong medical mental health diagnosis herself. And I think one of the things that we are facing in this tipping point of educational programs that we run is the fact that there have been a number of cuts to human services that results in the kind of barriers that were just mentioned, and yet not cognizant of the fact that in this case, this particular student probably runs close to $100,000 for education, not properly supported as a result of the cross-subsidy. We also have the student being transported probably close to $50,000 just to transport him one-to-one, one-on-one on a bus to our site. So this is a very expensive student not being having his needs properly addressed, and so cuts in other part of the system come up somewhere else, and it's often hard to ascertain how that happens, but trust me, we see it happening every single day. Thank you.
Dr. Runnenberg.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Jeff Runnenberg. I'm the superintendent of the Spring Lake Park Schools. For those of you that may not be aware, we serve families in the communities of the North Metro of Blaine, Fridley, and Spring Lake Park. We are growing, and growing district. Enrollment has increased by over 20% in the last 10 years, and we expect to increase by another 20%, growing from currently at about 5,300 students to 6,100 students. While growing in total enrollment, we are also seeing a more diverse student body with more varied and unique needs than we've ever seen before. About 40% of our students qualify for free and reduced lunch. 10 years ago, that was closer to 10%. So we've seen a significant increase. We see more and more students and their families living in crisis, and schools are being asked to provide wraparound services more than ever before. That's why I'm here today to talk with you about the Safe Schools Levy. For many districts, the current Safe Schools Levy is used to help pay for school liaison officers in their schools, and this base level of safety is important and needed. However, our teachers, as you've heard today, do encounter children with mental illness or early signs of mental illness in more advanced levels on a regular basis. We also experience families in crisis more than ever before, and parents struggling with poverty, substance abuse, or mental illness that impacts the learning of their children. Not so long ago in Spring Lake Park, we had a partnership that's been referred to here a couple of times with Anoka County, where we had four county social workers that partnered with us and worked in our district to provide services for families and students. When we saw a need that was outside our area of expertise or reach, we worked with the social worker to access services for students and sometimes their parents. As a principal at the time, I saw the direct and indirect benefits that these services provided for the students and their families. The students receiving those direct services benefited, as well as the many other students in the classrooms who were being impacted by the behaviors we saw from those other kids. Now we no longer have this partnership, and as a result, those supports for students and their families. Yet, as an example, Woodcrest Elementary School in Fridley, which is part of the Spring Lake Park Schools, it's a school of just over 400 K-3 students, has 65% poverty, approximately 55% non-white students, and approximately 20% having a first language other than English. We have identified, so we've looked at those families in crisis, we've identified 23 students who are not special education students, currently identified as special education students who are either personally in crisis or have parents who have mental health issues that are impacting their learning. We struggle to provide these kids with the necessary supports, and the learning of these students and others in their classrooms is impacted. We've had to clear classrooms because one student is acting out. When students are throwing chairs and knocking over desks, that's not safe for the 22 or 23 other first graders. And that will impact their learning for an entire day when we have to clear a classroom. So those kinds of things are happening on a regular basis in that school because those 23 kids are not in the same classroom. There's only about 16, 17 classrooms. So each of those classrooms is being impacted by these kids. It's amazing to see the lengths to which our staff goes, doing all in their power to support these kids and families. They're so committed to these kids. However, they lack the expertise or the community networks to provide or easily access the necessary services. It's sad to see the discouragement I see in these staff as they continue to struggle to find the necessary supports, and it's sad to see the kids struggle to learn when it's not them but their parents who are struggling. And we have few avenues to access supports like we did in the past. And I could go on with names of kids who were such bright, intelligent kids, but they either weren't getting to school on time because their parents didn't have the support. So it's both the kids and the families that we're trying to support. Our school psychologists and school social workers are not clinical therapists, nor should the school be paying for the medical needs, such as clinical therapies. Some of our schools in Minnesota have had success with the model, which brings clinical therapists into the school who are then able to, with parent permission, assist in treating those clinical needs. The challenge is that some of those critical activities of planning and reviewing with staff are not reimbursed through medical insurances. This increase in the Safe Schools levy will improve the opportunities for bringing these clinical services or social work services to schools by being a revenue source to pay for these unreimbursed costs. These investments in the mental health of students, especially with their mental health challenges, when their mental challenges are at the early onset, can help prevent them from becoming a lifelong debilitating disease. The mental health of our students is a real need. Many are living with or in conditions where they and or their families need support if they are to be successful. Expanding the services provided through the Safe Schools levy, allowing each school district to be flexible in their use of these funds to meet the unique needs of their students, can make a real difference for the learning of young people throughout the state.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ronenberg. Questions? Okay. Our next testifier is Ms. Thompson.
Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Chris Thompson, and I'm an assistant principal at Buffalo High School. We're part of the Buffalo-Hanover-Montrose School District. It's an independent school district on the west side of the cities, and we have about 1,600 students in our high school and a little over 6,000 students in our district. I would echo the concerns that I'm hearing from the speakers before me today. We are strapped for needs, for our mental health needs of our students, and also I would say our chemical health needs. As I'm sitting here listening, I want to be careful not to repeat what's already said, but also share a few stories of things that we've endured in a public school setting of what I would call an average school district in the state of Minnesota. In the last 2 years, we've worked with students who are waiting for beds in hospitals and inpatient facilities when those kids are required to come to school. We've had a student who his parents, mother was a teacher and father was a businessman in the community, are locking the doors at their home and the student is coming to school. And we're trying to keep our students safe from him and him from himself. We've had a student who has been called in by our bus company laying on the center of the road. As he came over the hill, he found one of our students. We had a student last fall who committed suicide. And this fall, we have a student who was required to come to school even though he was having thoughts of jumping over a railing from our second floor into our atrium. These are real. They're real parents. They're parents who are concerned and active, and the schools are required to teach these kids, and we need to, and these kids need to be supported. We've been very fortunate to obtain a grant over the past few years for an on-site chemical health counselor, a licensed chemical person who comes in It's once a month for 8 hours. It's not enough, but it's a start, and we're making connections with their students and with their families and getting them the resources in the community that they need. And we've also been a member of receiving LCTS hours, and again, we have a waiting list for that. Our students are many, and our opportunities to serve them are few. With those grants, and with an alternative to suspension program that we partnered with the county, with Right Choice, we work with probation, human services, and our mental health collaborative in our community. We are working with students off-site and creating connections for them into the community, but it's not enough. We're working with other schools within our county. We have 5 membership schools. We're trying, and we need support. We know that if we take care of the mental health and the chemical health of our students, we'll be able to educate them, and if we do not have that help, we're fighting a losing battle, and it's a losing battle for the kids and our communities. We are collectively raising these kids who are in turn going to be adults, and we want to help them make informed and responsible decisions about their chemical health and their mental health now through adulthood. More funding for the school-based mental and chemical health resources is necessary to support our kids. And with this increased financial funding for timely school-based mental and chemical health services, our students will have the opportunity to develop responsible decision-making that spans a lifetime. I appreciate your willingness to listen to us share our stories today. Thank you.
Well, we appreciate your being here and your service. Ms. Thompson, questions, the testifier? Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This conversation really strikes a chord with me. When I was growing up, my mom took this on and created a program called Project Charlie, and Charlie stood for Chemical Health Resolution Awareness Lies in Education, and it became a national curriculum. And so I really grew up just in the midst of understanding how important this was, and I grew up in Edina, and we had several suicides that were going on during that time, and that's how she got involved and just watching what was happening. And then I watched it with my own kids and just how pervasive the drug culture was. And I would say to people in the schools, don't you think the drugs are just, you know, really at the core of everything? And they would look at me blankly, like, are you here? You know? But it really was. And so I am left after this testimony with more questions than ever about, you know, what is the role of education dollars versus health dollars? And I don't know that we have the proper balance of resources in our schools to treat these issues, especially what I hear, like Ms. Lewandowski, talk about $100,000 a year kid. I mean, there's no possible way we can expect our education dollars to pay for $100,000 a year child. And not that he doesn't deserve the care, but where should the funding come from? And so I would just ask that somehow we partner with our Health and Human Services Committee to find out, is there a way to leverage more of those dollars? And they say, oh, they have diminishing dollars, but we all know there's a lot of dollars there. And so it seems as though we could do a better job accessing those dollars. Thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Johnson.
And Ms. Thompson, and thanks to your Mott Senator Bonhoff for Charlie's program. Ms. Thompson, you said it took grant funding to get a counselor to provide services. I assume you have at least one counselor at the high school as well, but probably with a high ratio of students.
Right. We're about 400-1 with our counseling ratio. And these are school counselors, not licensed mental health practitioners counselors. That person we have once a month for 8 hours. And there's a waiting list for that.
And when does that grant expire?
It's a yearly piece where we're turning in hours to get the money.
And the waiting list for students to asking for services?
At the high school, we're over 10. And we have an elementary piece that's private. It's not with our LCTS dollars. It's through Central Minnesota Mental Health. And she is partially funded through the school district and then partially in a grant through Central Minnesota Mental Health. And she works primarily with our elementary school students. We do not have counselors at an elementary school level. We have social workers, and the social worker time is tied to special ed students and their minutes on their IEP.
And are these requests triage? So for high priority intervention, something's going to happen?
Are. Yes, absolutely they are. And we use... Wright County is, I would say that we're very proactive in networking, and so with our crisis response team, all principals have access to those numbers where people are actually able to come into the home or out to the school if a student is in a state of rage and they're unsafe for themselves or for the people they're around.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson from the Association of Secondary School Principals.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Don Johnson. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Secondary Principals Association. I represent the 1,100 active and a couple hundred more inactive principals in the state of Minnesota, inactive because they retired. And I also just retired myself at the end of this past June as the high school principal from Owatonna. And I've been a principal for 25 years in Minnesota. And prior to that, I was a guidance counselor and social studies teacher for another 15 years. And so I'm here to speak in support of the Safe Schools Levy. And I really would like to narrow my comments upon two of the portions of it, one of them having to do with school counselors. You may or may not know the fact that the ratio of students to counselors in Minnesota is absolutely the highest in the nation. And actually, I speak that's not quite accurate. I think we're number 49 this year. But we have vied for 49th and 50th spot over the past several years. And it's not because we have fewer problems than students of other states. It's simply because, I don't know, so the Lake Wobegon effect, that somehow we think our students don't need that. I don't know what I can attribute that to. But the fact of the matter is our students have very, very dramatic needs. And when I think of the role of school counselor, again, a role I played myself for several years, I thought of myself as an interventionist, trying to identify those students with significant needs. And if I could address some of those needs myself, I was willing to do so. But many of the needs were far greater than anything I could address in the school system. When I graduated from high school in 1969, I had a guidance counselor. And the vast majority of his time was spent doing career guidance, you know, changing schedules. He called me in. We talked about colleges to apply for. And that really consisted probably of 95 to 99% of his job. That is no longer the case anymore. The vast majority of our counselors in Minnesota these days spend the vast majority of their time intervening in mental health issues of various degrees. And in fact, if anything, there's a bit of a backlash right now that I experienced as a principal. I would get phone calls from parents wondering why their senior or junior son or daughter wasn't getting more time with help applying for colleges, selecting colleges, selecting courses. And the fact of the matter is, counselors don't have time for that anymore. They're dealing with the urgent in a day-by-day basis. And then I also want to respond briefly to the school resource officers that we have in our schools. I had the privilege at Owatonna High School to work with a school resource officers over those years. Actually, I worked with three different school resource officers. Again, police officers that were paid partially by the school district and partially by the city of Owatonna. And what a tremendous resource that person was. And frankly, when I first went to Owatonna, I had not had that privilege of having a school resource officer to work with. And his office was just around the corner from mine. And I thought, I wonder what he really does during his day. And I found out quickly that he was a very busy man. The fact of the matter is he spent much of his time working directly with my assistant principals, dealing with ongoing student issues of various degrees. And his role was really being that of a proactive member of our team, not a reactive. Now, that's not saying that there weren't incidents that he had to respond to in an emergency kind of basis. But the fact of the matter is he was the one oftentimes who was doing counseling of various kinds with students. And of course, students knowing that he was a school resource officer, that went a long ways in terms of helping them make, shall we say, better decisions. When you're sitting there with an assistant principal and a school resource officer and you're a student, you somehow thinking becomes a little clearer in terms of the decisions you're going to make. And I'm intrigued, and of course I think of the various situations we've encountered as a state over recent weeks, the issue out in Mound, West Tonka, the issue that happened in Minneapolis South High School, an issue that happened not too long ago, I believe, in Farmington. The fact of the matter is, you know, school resource officers and assistant principals and counselors all work together as team members to try to alleviate these situations before they happen. And the fact of the matter is we would have far many more these kinds of situations occur if we weren't for counselors and school resource officers acting together as, along with the principals to make sure these don't get out of hand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions? I had one question. We aren't proud of the high ratio that counselors have. We are concerned about the unmet needs that have been documented. We'll see what happens on resources. Sometimes we put in ratios or mandatory ratios that you, for example, counselors, but at the same time, sure, you ask for flexibility. Could you comment on the approach where we get very prescriptive versus flexibility for the local school? Because as a principal, you're going to put together that FTE with the superintendent, and the principal's primarily going to decide what that staffing pattern will be, whether it's a dean, a counselor, sure, social worker, counselors, so...
When I first came to Owatonna High School 7 years ago at this point in time, we had 4 guidance counselors and we had 2 social workers and a school resource officer. I also had 2 assistant principals. At that time, we had about 1,600 students. 6 years later, we had still had about 1,600 students, but I had lost 1 counselor and I had lost 1 social worker. Because of funding. I mean, as you know, as a state, we've been struggling with finances and are in a difficult economy over the past several years. But again, the issue of that was not at my request, so to speak. The funding, the pot all comes out of the same pot, generally speaking. And the fact of the matter is we were trying to create less and less of an impact in the classroom. We saw average classroom sizes go from approximately 25 to about 32 during that time period, but of course with some highs of as high as 42 and 44 in some classes. And again, they can't get any higher. Frankly, it was a physical problem. We had classrooms that couldn't hold any more students, so we had to keep them, many of them, at 34, 35 because we couldn't get another desk in the room. So we had to make cuts elsewhere, and again, we'd already cut several teachers, and so we were at a point where we had to cut elsewhere. And the fact of the matter is, classroom teachers are looking elsewhere, and as are principals and superintendents and school boards. And the fact of the matter is, we had no place else to go but start cutting those kinds of people that were interventionists as far as our student needs. I don't know if that answered your question directly or not.
Well, you point out the frustration, lack of resources, where you'd like to be fully staffed, but you've got to make tough choices.
You asked about flexibility. I felt I had less and less flexibility over time. How's that for an answer?
Yes, Sarah Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a very similar question. I'm working on the secondary to post-secondary alignment piece in terms of making sure that our kids are graduating ready to go into post-secondary, and the issue of counseling, and we're going to talk about testing and data and what we're going to do with that, and we need professionals in the buildings who have time and resources to have those conversations so that we're not spending, as I understand it, about $90 million as a state doing remediation at the college level. So all of these things become very interrelated, and I just want to sort of second Senator Wigger's question and ask for guidance. As we talk about these things, I've heard over and over exactly what you just said, that school districts have been placed in the position of having to make cuts and doing every last thing they can do to avoid making those cuts in classrooms. Well, obviously, we see where that has been coming from, and that has ripple effects into so many different areas of our students' lives. So the question is, if we're going to start trying to rebuild this, how do we do it in a way that provides the flexibility but make sure we're providing these different types of support other than just throwing more money than we have at it? So any guidance you can provide there would be welcome now or later.
Yeah. Mr. Johnson, if you'd like to elaborate any further, and I invite Ms. Thompson as well, and then Senator Pratt, we'll get to you in a moment.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I think a comment was made by Senator Johnson earlier about the fact that our main purpose is reading, writing, arithmetic, but none of that takes place until we have a student who's safe, a student who is mentally stable, if I can put it that way. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, over the years, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of instability in students' mental health. And so, yes, while our greatest desire is to address reading, writing, arithmetic, the fact of the matter is it becomes almost a secondary goal, if I can put it that way, unfortunately, of our schools, because we are the great melting pot. We are the organization that pulls all of it together, and where everybody wants to send their sons and daughters every morning on the school bus. And so we are probably the most likely place for those kinds of things to take place. But the fact of the matter is mental health is critical to doing our jobs.
Ms. Thompson.
Thank you. We have an idea, and we're running a pilot program through our school district, and we're collaborating with schools in our county. We call it a Right Choice Alternative to Suspension program. We've allocated a 0.5 FTE, and the five other schools have each contributed $5,000 so that students that are suspended are still receiving education in an off-site spot. Right now we're in the basement of our courthouse. And there we've collaborated with Human Services, Central Minnesota Mental Health, and probation, where we're running some early screeners with those students, and so we can provide some information to parents and also hook those kids up with people who work within the county. Because part of it is connecting the hands of the students and the parents to people and the resources within your community. The challenge for us is we have to allocate 0.5 to put in that spot, and that's where it takes away from our classroom and it increases their classroom sizes. That being said, it's important for us to help these students change behaviors and get the help that they need now, or we have bigger problems later. If we just suspend them from school, we cross our fingers and hope they come back not mad and ready to learn, but we know that's not real. But that's what's typically been done. And so we're trying this pilot program. We're having success. We're working with probation. We've presented an MDE. So there are ways to connect those hands, as you mentioned, with people that are the specialists in those areas and bring them together. And really, that's going to be key. And again, that takes some time and some money and a little bit of creativity, but there are people willing to do it for the kids. And if we say we are going to do what's best for kids, then I'd like to see us keep moving forward to help those kids get the resources they need. As Mr. Johnson said, it's not our school counselors. It's licensed mental health practitioners, and it's licensed chemical dependency people. And those two become intertwined very quickly. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago, we had a student party that was busted, and it used to be beer drinking parties. This was a marijuana party, and some ecstasy ended up there. 50 kids. 26 of them were kids in our activities. State High School League consequences. We have 8 hours a month where we work with a chemical dependency person and to get those kids into her hands to help her start making those choices. Because the students, quite honestly, have decriminalized in society, decriminalized marijuana use, and they say the kids say it's only weed. You know, we don't smoke, we don't drink, what do you want us to do? And we start with that educational piece. But again, our hands are tied, and we react. We do not have the resources to educate, to work with them through these treatment facilities. And so we say don't do that and try to get them some help. But we're fighting a losing battle on that part. And I think of two students in particular that I met with parents at 7 o'clock on a Friday night before a basketball game. And it's a mental health, chemical health comorbid condition where these kids are unhappy, anxious students but find that marijuana helps them to cope and feel whatever their normal is. It's difficult. I've been to Teen Challenge. I've been to Clara's house. I've went with students where they're at as they're transitioning back in the schools, and they want help. They really do. And
I bet their parents are really
their parents
out.
Are there, and they want help as well. And it takes an entire community, and that's where the schools become part of that. Sorry, I get emotional. I talk about these kids.
No, yeah. We feel it. And, Dr. Romberg, just a moment. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you,
and then,
Mr.
Excuse
Chair.
Me, Senator Pratt had a question first.
I'll go ahead and yield.
Okay, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Thompson, I'm very interested in having a follow-up conversation with you in my office. We are trying to put together a bill and just come up with some language to support schools in their efforts to pursue different models for suspension. And it seems like you know, every time I hear a district, pursuing something on their own, I feel like, districts are doing incredible work and We need to learn from you, the rest of the districts. You know, every district is doing something different, and it's good for us to hear how successful you are in pursuing practices on your own, but we need to help you with that. We need to figure out, you know, how do we put resources into that? How do we encourage the counties to work with you, build those collaborative efforts? Chemical dependency is huge. You can't imagine how much I hear, you know, in my own kids' group, and I have two adolescents, and it's a very complicated environment for kids. So I'm very interested in having a meeting with you to talk about how we can put legislation together to expand the model that you are working on.
Thank you.
Yeah, be noted, and I think most of you read just in my own district over the weekend, a 16-year-old girl who had an altercation at school and suspended, and don't know all the details, but you know, she was murdered. You know, just, you know, while out of school, then found in a park, and you know, the kids crying for help, and that didn't justify what actions may have led to the suspension, but they still need help, and sometimes it, you know, becomes a real sad story that you read about, and it happens throughout our state. It doesn't. It's not just one particular area. So, thank you, Senator Ray, for your efforts in that as well. Dr. Romberg.
In regards to the question about, you know, what might the ratios be, how do we look at that? I guess in a nutshell, what I say is the last thing as a superintendent that I need is another ratio or another mandate. Over the past couple of weeks, I've been meeting with each one of our principals. We've had one-on-one meetings, myself, Director of Business Services, Director of Educational Services, and principals. And what they've been coming with is their instructional model, their leadership model, to be able to really improve student learning, address educational needs, mental health needs of students. The challenge we have is, as we do that, then we look at, now how the heck do we fund this? Because we have to use compensatory resources this way, Title I resources this way, and we have all these silos of resources that can only be used for specific staff or at specific schools. And we have maybe a little bit more than we need at one school and not enough at another school. I shared the story earlier about Woodcrest Elementary School, 65% poverty. Another school in our district is about 20% poverty. Their needs as far as social work counselor needs are very different. So we don't need a mandate on how to do that, but the flexibility to provide the services we need at each site for those individual kids. Because that's, my office is filled now with chart paper with what we're wanting to do, but then now how do we figure out how do we fund it? And we put, there's tons of staff hour times that go in just to figuring out which codes go where to be able to use these resources. So really what we need is kind of just that increase with the Safe Schools Levy, and then in some cases it's a social worker, sometimes it's a counselor. We've been able to maintain our guidance counselors in our district, but it was the partnerships we had with Anoka County that went away. And just two quick examples. And Dante, when I was a principal, was a student that was living in a home that was just struggling, and the social worker was able to get the mom support, Dante to support that was needed to help Dante be successful. Now just this year at that same school, the principal went, the mother, in one day this happened to this student. Student, during the day, father was arrested for parole violation. Mom was arrested for her fourth driving while intoxicated, was taken to jail during the day. The child went home, and the grandma had been arrested, was a meth addict. So we got a call because this child, second grader, was sitting on the stoop of their mobile home in Fridley with nobody there. So the principal went, worked with the police. The student was taken to a home in Minneapolis. The principal, because there was no social worker, anybody else, the principal went and stayed with the student until it was lights out because she didn't want the student to be alone. Yeah. It's the lengths to which the staff is going, but her frustration was the next day, now what for this child? Mm-hmm. And that's where, in the past, I would have called Joe Whaling, was the social worker, and Joe would right away be working to find those supports. We don't have that resource now. That's the type of resource in our system we need. But what they might need in Mountview next to us or in Okehennepin may be different. What Sandy Lewandowski needs with 287 would be a different resource. So I think it's more important to look at how do we provide the language that this bill provides to give more flexibility in how you use those and then increase those resources.
Thank you. Senator Pratt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Runnenberg, I agree. One of the aspects of the bill that I like is allowing additional flexibility for local districts and communities to decide what their needs are. And if it's more support for mental health, whatever we need to do to keep our schools safe. I'm also pleased that it seems to be the direction of this committee to support a separate safe schools levy versus rolling it into the general to the general formula as proposed by the governor. So I'm supportive of the direction that we seem to be going there. But it seems like we also have a policy issue here, and I think Senator Torres-Ray touched on that. This is not a problem that's going to be solved by more money. We're already spending $100,000 on a student, and more money isn't going to make our schools any safer. The problem we have is that we've got students and dangerous students, and I have examples from my own district, in inappropriate settings that are disrupting the learning that Senator Johnson said is the primary mission of our schools. And so I'm a little bit torn here in the fact that I don't know that necessarily increasing the levy is going to fix the problem as much as it is getting the barriers out of the way so that these students are in a more appropriate setting than our public schools. Mr. Chair, if I may, one more question now that I've kind of gone. I'd like to talk about the Section 2 and your objective with PBIS and if there was nothing in the fiscal note addressing that, and I was wondering if there was any additional information that you could provide on Section 2.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, after Holden with NAMI. Right now, the PBIS program is funded with federal dollars, and once you've been in it for about 3 years, then schools start to need to use their own dollars. And because there's a waiting list and it is an evidence-based practice and has showed to really reduce some of the behaviors that they see in the schools before things become more critical, we wanted to look at providing some state funding for this effort. We need the department's help in developing a fiscal note. That's not something that the advocacy groups can do very easily. So we really need from them information about, so how much does it cost to start one school up and, those types of things. So we would need help from the department.
Thank you. Ms. Mundowski.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your intense listening today. I do really appreciate it, and I appreciate your question zeroing in on the policy. We do need the Safe Schools Levy increase just to keep us stable for the upcoming couple of years, but inherent in this whole discussion, I would say is that policy question. Schools have shifted to becoming the provider for many, many other entities. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that my district does an extraordinary job serving 95% of these very high-need students. We get excellent results. We work with families. But there is a limit to the ability of the schools based on competing legal rights. And that's the tipping point I believe my district is in, is that students have incredible legal rights based on their special education needs. And they have every right to have that kind of security. But when I can no longer keep my staff safe, I have a right employees have a right to a safe environment. And that policy discussion is one I would urge you to have. We've had many tragedies in schools over the last number of years. I can tell you I am surprised we have not had a tragedy of enormity in my district. I want to be able to say that I did everything I could. I told everybody that would listen that we need to deal with this basic policy issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Aberholm.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pratt, I just want to note, too, that this is one of 12 bills So we have really come in this session with a wide range of things that we think could help children, particularly with mental illnesses, both in the human services side, actually in higher ed as well, because we don't have enough mental health professionals and practitioners. So what can we do through collaboration with MNSCU to bring more people into the field so that we can meet the needs of kids? So we really have stepped back, and we took a very global view of what needed to be done to really improve all the areas of government that touch a child's life, to make sure that they're getting the services that they need. So I want to reassure you that from NAMI's point of view, it isn't just the schools. It's the Department of Human Services. It's our, frankly, even private insurance. It's all of that that we need to look at.
Is there anyone in the audience that'd like to testify that hasn't? Okay, Senator Johnson, closing.
Mr. Chairman, and I thank everyone also for your attention today. I sense tears in everybody's hearts and probably in your eyes. And, you know, we can't afford to lose this battle. One of the testifiers said that. This is an ongoing battle, and we cannot afford to lose it. It is our future. These children, as needy as they might be, they have the potential to grow up to be productive citizens, the great majority of them. Maybe not everyone, but they must be cared for. And so that's why we're all working together, and I sense a real cooperative effort will be working together on this bill, and that we will meet the needs that our schools so diligently are trying to take care of the children. I think when Dr. Ronneberg told me that they lost the four social workers that were available to them previously for money reasons, not because anyone thought it wasn't important. I think that to me says right now, as our testifier said, that for now we need to have some money to give to our schools to give them the opportunity to work on this issue until we settle it ourselves. Hopefully we'll have a summit someday on this issue. Thank you, members.
Thank you very much, Senator Johnson. As we indicated earlier, it'll be laid over for possible inclusion. As the members know, tomorrow in this room, around this time or so, the forecast will be shared with the public. And as you know as well, in the statutory formula, if there is any surplus, I don't know, I'm hoping there is, but if there is, that would go toward the shift. And within due time, we'll get the targets, the various funding divisions as to the amount of money we're going to look for our respective budgets. E-12 has traditionally had the largest chunk amongst that, and be advocating the various concerns that we've seen here. We know that there's more needs that have been identified, program needs, than we'll have enough money for. We know that, and then as we put together a formula that's going to look at all of Minnesota, that'll be the big challenge, but we're up to it. I mentioned that Tax Committee is meeting right now in 15 and actually talking about some aspects for the schools and taxation on property. And so I'm actually going to go down there right now and listen, and as we have a little time left from our meeting. At our schedule, it's noted on the agenda. Next week on the 5th, we're going to hear Senator Kiffmeyer's bill, Senate File 522, for District 728 in Elk River. It's a fund transfer authorization. On Wednesday, we're having a joint meeting with the House, and that'll be in room 200 in the State Office Building. We'll discuss the legislative auditor's report on special education. That will start at 8:15. Also, next week on the 7th, we have Senator Bonoff's bill, Senate File 221, which addresses the location equity index. And we've had that in the past, but these issues are still before us. Something that was included in the work group on finance. So, and there could be others scheduled as well, but we'll do our very best to keep you posted on that. Any questions, members, at this point?
Not tough. For all the testifiers, thank you for sharing your information and for your thoughtful participation and involvement this morning. We're adjourned.